The Secrets of Middle-Earth is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Middle-Earth, where we discuss the hidden themes and deeper layers found in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, whether in his writings or in any of the media derived from them. I'm your host, Thomas Salerno, and joining me today on the panel are Jeff Hecker. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Thomas.
And Patrick Mason. Hey there, Pat.
Howdy, Thomas.
And be sure to follow along with The Secrets of Middle-Earth on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, or any podcast directory or app. And you can find us on social media, where we are on Facebook at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, or on X, where we are at SQPN, or on Instagram, where we are at StarQuest Network. And also, don't forget about all the great Middle-Earth merch, Secrets of Middle-Earth stuff that you can get at our store at sqpn.com/merch, including our awesome t-shirt that I'm wearing right now. You can't see it because it's a recording, but it's, you know, it's got all the races of Middle-Earth, plus I believe it's the Hail Mary in Quenya that goes around the races. It's really cool. And it's a great way for you guys to support our show and to celebrate Tolkien's wonderful world of Middle-Earth. And so this is going to be our third installment of our Silmarillion series. And don't worry, folks, if you missed the previous two episodes, you can go back and listen to them. I have the episode numbers right here. We covered the beginning sections of the Silmarillion, the Ainulindale and the Vala Quenta, in episode 50 of this podcast. And we covered the first two chapters of the Silmarillion proper, or the Quenta Silmarillion, in episode 54. So, you know, if you're coming in late and you want to get the full Silmarillion story, you can go back and listen to those. And of course, full spoilers is on. We're going to be analyzing this as minutely as we can. So if you've never read the Silmarillion before, perhaps read along with us, read the chapters, and then come and listen to this episode, which should be pretty easy because these are pretty short chapters. We're doing chapters 3 through 5 today of the Quenta Silmarillion. But before we dive in, I know that there has been some concern in the Tolkien community over the latest crop of Rings of Power rumors. I was on Twitter the day that broke, and it was just a huge mess. But I think our friend Caitlin, who's been on our show before when we discussed the first season of Rings of Power, on her website, Tea with Tolkien, she has a great blog post where she breaks down like 20 of the most prominent recent rumors and ranks them by like what's most likely versus what's like crazy, insane, probably never going to happen. So we'll include a link to that in the show notes. At least I really hope some of that stuff doesn't happen. did you hear about some of this stuff?
Yeah, I made the comment that, you know, if it's a Tom Bombadil thing happens, it's like maybe the Discord was the Hey Dole, Mary Dole. Was the Discord in the Anya Mandalay?
No!
Yeah. I actually kind of want to see him try to do the Anya Mandalay. Because that was one of the rumors, is that there was,
yes,
you know, the season was going to start that way. And I'm like, I'm kind of curious to see if they can pull it off and make it look good.
Yeah, I think they could pull that off. It's just a matter of like of the changing of the characters like we were talking about, because that particular rumor was that Tom Bombadil was actually Melkor, or I guess Morgoth at that point, being punished or something.
Or doing penance.
Yeah, doing penance. So.
And that like Goldberry was Ungoliant or something. Like, just like, but no, I really think that. Yes.
What?
Yeah.
That wasn't even the craziest one either. Of the.
It wasn't?
How is that not the craziest one?
What was the one about Shadowfax? Wasn't there one about.
Oh, that Shadowfax was like alive in the Second Age or something like that. And I'm like, no. I'm like, he's. Okay, no, he can understand what people say, but he's not an immortal horse. Like, he's not that it turns kind out of magic horse. Like,
he's actually R2-D2.
No, it was... I thought it was something even more ridiculous than that. Let me see if I can... I'm going to pull up her blog post right now. Let me see if I can find it.
Right.
I thought it was something, like, really crazy that would be... No way true.
Oh, are you thinking of the one where Celebrian is evil?
No, it was something. Okay. I thought it was something about Shadowfax, but.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was pretty crazy.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it was just that Shadowfax, that Gandalf will meet Shadowfax, or that the stranger will be Gandalf and that will be Shadowfax or something. So that was maybe I thought it was something crazier than that. But I guess that's not compared to the Tom Bombadil thing. It's not.
it's tough to beat that.
That's the one that basically had social media like melting down and like. Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, okay. I'm like,
oh, here, and Sauron having a son, apparently.
All right. Yeah. Well, it's funny because if you remember from that was a theory of mine early on last season that they were going to give him a son, but they didn't. So I was like, oh, okay. I forget why I thought that. Oh, you know what it was? It was because Theo's blood activated the knight.
Oh yeah.
And so I thought that meant Theo was Sauron's son, but that apparently did not happen. So apparently just anybody can stick the blade into their forearm.
I think it just needed like blood to activate her. It might maybe, blood of the Southland or something, but
right. Hmm. Yeah. And I saw one rumor. I don't think that was in this initial batch that the stranger is going to meet up with another wizard in the East who will kind of train him in the proper kind of use of his powers, because his powers were kind of all over the place last season. And so if that's true, then it may be the other blue wizard, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah. I kind of hope that he is a blue wizard and not Gandalf, just because like I'm okay with them changing small things, but I feel like, you know, if you're going to do, you know, Gandalf was done so perfectly, like let's not do that again, or at least in a make up a new story that doesn't make sense to the canon. So, but you know, we shall see. Yeah. And we were talking before, there's no trailer. We thought we'd get one at the Super Bowl.
No trailer at the big game. It can't be because Amazon can't afford it, but it's like, but I feel like at the same time, like they might be still working on stuff like in post with all the delays with the strikes and stuff like that. So I don't know. The other thing I wanted to mention was that Caitlin Fischista is also writing a book. She announced it on her blog. I don't know if I don't think I mentioned this last time. If I'm repeating myself, I'm sorry. But yeah, she's writing a book about Middle Earth, and we'll include a link to that announcement in the show notes. And let me just bring this up real quick, because I want to see what I'm forgetting what publisher it's with. I think it's with Ave Maria Press. Yeah, my link is not working right now. Oh, well. But yeah, I believe it's with Ave Maria Press, and it's a book about Middle Earth. And
yeah, so Ave Maria Press. Yes, great. That is correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm really looking forward to that because I love her blog posts. And so I can't wait to read something book length about Middle Earth from Caitlin. So when it comes out, we'll have to have like a launch party on the show. We'll have to get her back on and do.
And yeah. Thing. And just as a reminder to our listeners, like she has a whole reading guide for the Silmarillion. So you can, you know, follow that along. You know, she has I believe she does a podcast there as well. So
yeah, podcast
definitely version, lots of resources to, you know, so I don't think we'll do justice what she does, but we'll do our best.
As I mentioned, we've previously covered both the creation of Arda, the Ainul Indalay, the Valaquenta, which kind of gives us the rundown of the Valar and the Maiar. And we've talked about the first two chapters of the proper Silmarillion, which included Melkor destroying the lamps, which were these mountain sized lamps, which were the original source of light for Arda. And we covered the creation of the dwarves with Aule, and of course Yavanna, his wife Yavanna, wanting her own race after her husband illicitly creates the dwarves. We get the origin of Ents as well, which is really cool. But yeah, we're actually covering three chapters tonight. The first of which is chapter three, The Coming of the Elves, which kind of picks up where we left off with at the end of the first chapter, where because the second chapter with Aule and the dwarves kind of takes a side, you know, kind of a side off ramp from the main story. And so we kind of get back on here with Melkor building his fortresses of Utumno and Angband. And I think this is our first entry of Sauron into the main story, right? Because he's put in as the lieutenant of Angband.
Yeah. Yeah, stationed at the watchtower to watch for invasion from Aman.
It's interesting because later, Angband becomes the main fortress after Utumno gets wrecked. So it's funny that here, it's just like his kind of outpost to like guard against the coming of the potential coming of the Valar. And I like how they have that thing where the Valar are trying to figure out what to do. So they hold a council and it's like, should we do something? Or maybe not. You know, it's like, if you've ever seen, there's an episode of that YouTube show Atop the Fourth Wall where he's covering one of the DC Crisis comic books. And in DC, there's these uber powerful beings called the Monitors. And like the whole multiverse is at stake. And they're sitting in a council basically going, should we do something? We should do something. Should we do something? And it's like,
well, it's funny. It's almost like thinking about it. It's almost like the Council of the Ent, or the Entmoot in Two Towers. Like they're just these, you know, higher beings sitting around, you know, talking. And then you have the impulsive, you know, hobbits, or in this case, you have Tulkas coming in and being, you know, let's go and make war. Like he's, you know, in his wrestler persona, like let's, you know, let's run into the ring and bring it to him. Bring it to Melkor.
Let's do this thing. Bring the pain.
Yeah, I like how he basically says, why are we letting one guy stand up to the rest of us? Mm-hmm. You know, but of course, the counter argument is we don't want to actually kind of destroy where the children of Iluvatar are supposed to live. Because we don't know when or where exactly they're going to show up. And there was an interesting bit where they talked about how, okay, when they were Ainur in the Timeless Halls with Iluvatar, they could kind of see the whole history of Arda play out in broad strokes before them. But once they enter into Arda, they kind of lose some of that infused knowledge. So the Valar don't actually know, except for Mandos, who seems to know more. Most of them don't know the specifics about the future.
Yeah, it says like basically no matter what, they're going to get surprised. Mm-hmm. And it says that when Orome finds the elves, he's like, he's so stunned by their appearance. And it talks about like after entering, no matter what, they all end up surprised by something. I love the councils because I envision like, there's a whole bunch of people talking and there's lots of back and forth and everything. And then like they make a decision and then Mandos finally speaks up. Well, you guys are hosed now. Like, why didn't you talk? Why didn't you say anything? Like, why did you wait until we made the decision to tell us that it was a bad one? This track record of Mandos like not saying anything, and then they make a decision, and then he pronounces the doom, and you're like, why you gotta be that way, bro?
Well, if he had said something about it, they would have done the opposite thing. So it's like there's a doom either way, probably.
Yeah. I know later he gives like a prophecy which is so vague, I don't know how anybody was supposed to take any information from it. But
Well, he's like, all right, so we're not going to do anything. So, well, they were supposed to be born in darkness and they're going to see the stars and they're going to love. What's her name?
Varda,
the bringer of the stars.
Yeah. Varda Elbereth.
Yeah. And that causes her to go off and actually like take action.
make more star. Because she created the stars before, but now she makes essentially the constellations, it seemed like to me, what they were talking about. Because they mentioned, I can't pronounce its name. I think it's Minelvigor or something like that. The
Nelmakar.
Okay, yeah. The one that's basically Orion, because they mentioned it has a shining belt. And I believe the sickle of the Valar is supposed to be what we call the Big Dipper or the Bear.
Yeah.
Seven Sisters.
Oh, it's the Seven Sisters. That's a separate constellation, right?
I think so.
The Pleiades.
Actually, right? No. I think, I don't know, because it was very specific about they were seven.
Seven, right.
Which is the Pleiades cluster, but I'm not absolutely certain that that's what he was going for.
Right, yeah. Because I know in Tolkien's astronomy, there's some one-to-one correlations and others where I'm just like, I don't know what star you're talking about, but...
Right.
But yeah, that was cool. Although, like, we get... I'm like, Tolkien is infamous for having, like, multiple names for people. The number of names he gives for Varda is... I don't think any other character has that many names. He must mention, like, half a dozen different names for her.
Yeah, I remember, like, blanking out for a moment and then coming back and be like, oh, no, he's still naming names for the same person. No way I'm going to remember... I can barely remember Varda. That's easy. Talking like two syllables here. Some of these have like seven.
But I guess it just shows you like the elves' extreme reverence for Varda. They have so many like beautiful names for this one being, you know, and how much they reverence her and her creation of the stars. Because remember, folks, at this point, the sun and moon aren't actually a thing in creation yet. The sun and moon have not been created. Middle Earth is plunged into pretty much darkness at this point. You have Valinor or Aman being lit by the two trees, which we described in a previous episode. But at this point, Middle Earth is dark. Varda comes and actually puts all the plants that she created into kind of a hibernation, which was cool because I mean, otherwise, how are they going to live? Yeah. But then it mentions like these. I thought this was very interesting. The land is like covered in these dark, shadowy creatures that Tolkien doesn't really describe. And I was like, oh, are those supposed to be the nameless things that are briefly mentioned in the Fellowship of the Ring as having been driven under the earth?
Yeah, they're like these dark. It was like ancient dark creatures that hang out in valleys. I'm sure he didn't say hang out, but it's like, and I was like, I made the same connection. I'm like, I wonder if these are the nameless things that Gandalf met and then dropped that they exist and then moved on. And you're like, wait, hold up. Like, I want to know more.
When my brother got to that part in the Fellowship of the Ring, he comes up to me and he's like, Gandalf went to the center of the earth and met these like things that he doesn't describe. And when does he come back to that? I'm like, never. I'm like, he never mentions it again. And my brother's just like,
are you kidding me? What?
Yeah.
Well, come on.
But actually, that's one of the things I love about Middle Earth is that there are just these unsolved mysteries that we'll never know the answer to, because it allows me to fill in my own ideas in my head. And I think they say when Varda creates these new constellations and new stars, that's pretty much the moment when the elves awake.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like they were debating about whether to take any action. Mando says, well, you know, they need the stars first, and then Varda goes and does it, and then the elves awake. I'm like, oh, so they could have done that a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I always imagine that Iluvatar is the one who kind of woke up the elves, so he was kind of waiting for the, you know, the in his plan, it would have, you know, maybe included the stars, so, like, that was all part of his plan, so he was waiting for that to, you know, kind of the Valar to get there on their own before, you know, waking up the elves by the waters of Cuvain, and, which I'm probably saying that wrong, but...
I could never pronounce it right either.
I don't know how Andy Serkis pronounces it in the, or, you know, any other narrators.
Oh, yeah.
But,
no, Cuvain... That's how they pronounce it in the audiobook I've got.
Yeah.
Cuvanon. Okay.
Cuvanon.
And it's like, it's interesting that it says the elves are not created at that moment. They awake, which implies that they were created before by Iluvatar and put into some kind of sleep until Varda creates the constellations.
Well, it's kind of like they, you know, or were they created before the, or for the dwarves, or had the, did Ali create the dwarves? And then Iluvatar put them to sleep because he's like, no, it's not, you know, I need, the elves have to come first. So I don't know if, you know, I don't know if it's been, I can't remember if that chapter really said one way or the other, if the elves actually were created first or if the dwarves were created first, but.
Right. Well, the elves were going to awake first regardless.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, a similar thing, like Iluvatar created them and, you know, probably they weren't awakened or conscious, you know, I'm assuming they weren't like the automatons that the dwarves were before, you know, they were given that life-giving, you know, that spirit by Iluvatar. But I'm kind of imagining that they were, you know, placed there for probably a while before the stars, you know. It's kind of interesting because the Valar, the music is what created Arda, and Yavanna's, you know, power gave life to all the plants and all the animals and things like that. But like these, what's actually conscious, that would have come from Iluvatar. And so like, did he, you know, sneak in there? Maybe the shapeless things were Iluvatar, you know, sneaking through to put his children.
Well, it's Iluvatar has the secret fire.
Right.
Which I assume is like, is the creation of like rational beings, rational souls.
Yeah,
or like souls.
The spirit. Yeah. I'm going to say, I was thinking, isn't there a word Fea that means like life, you know, life spirit or something like that. I don't know if that.
And it also means, oh no, wait, no. Cause it's interesting. Fea, the name Feanor means spirit of fire, right, or soul of fire.
Okay.
Which we'll get to him in a later episode, or I think he's name dropped in a later episode.
Yeah, this is the chapter of names. Like, if you were to just get punched in the face by name after name after name, this is it. This chapter is all about that.
Right. So in my Silmarillion copy that I have here, the appendix says Fea means spirit, and spirit of fire. So I think Fea is like that life giving principle that, you know, or that, you know, rational, conscious, you know, soul, whatever you want to say.
And I guess there's more about the awakening of the elves in the history of Middle Earth.
Yeah. Whenever I'm like reading Tolkien, I always go down rabbit holes. And so I haven't read this in the actual history, but it's always kind of fascinated me about the creation of the elves and like the actual, like, cause in this chapter in the Silmarillion, it's very like the elves woke up and they were found by Oromain, you know, very high overview, but never like, no, like, the first elf was this guy. But if you read the history, it's in there. But in my memory, I was thinking that was in the Silmarillion. And so as I was reading, I was like, wait, did I miss a whole section that like goes through the, cause it gives you in the history, it talks about all the, like the first elf and his wife who woke up and the people he found and there were several other groups that they kind of all collected. And the first elf was kind of salty because he thought he was better because he was the first to wake up or something. But yeah, if you look, there's a lot more in the history. So that's something I definitely am going to check out, you know, check out at some point.
Strikes me as very elf like. Strikes me as very human too.
Yeah. Cause I was like, I think when I read the Silmarillion the last time a couple of years ago, I was like, okay, so who was the first elf? Like, what was his name? And he has a name and a backstory, which I can try to pull it up on the internet here. But if you read the history, but I was thinking that was all in the Silmarillion. And so I was like flipping through after I read, I was like, did I miss something? But no, it turns out it was just from the rabbit hole I went down, a couple of years ago that I had this memory. And that was something that we talked about in the Rings of Power is I was thinking that maybe something that the stranger was looking for might be Cuvanon somehow, like, cause it's been lost to history in Middle Earth. Like, I don't know that they say it's destroyed, but maybe that's what they're looking for in, you know, and it could lead to, you know, cause that's a whole like plot line that they could really delve into. in the show if they wanted to.
The elves, the way they put it in the Silmarillion, the elves say it's a place that you can never go back to.
Mm-hmm. Like Eden.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that is that, like, it's very literal in the sense of it will never be lit in the same way again, because there's a sun and a moon now. There's, like, the stars are different. Like, there are things about the Middle Earth that have changed so drastically from when they awoke that it even if you could go to the same physical, like, piece of patch of geo-located Earth, it wouldn't be the same, right? And in fact, it's on a globe now instead of being on a flat Earth. So,
right.
You know, that may mean, like, there's no way back because it doesn't exist anymore. There's no way back because even if it does exist, it's just not the same. It's not the place we woke up in anymore.
It's not how they remember it. Yeah.
Right.
That's so elvish, too, that whole thing. They always lose everything. That sense of loss that, like, we can never they have this nostalgia for a past they can never recover. And so I think that that's very appropriate. Another thing that I really liked about this chapter is that we have kind of the most canon version of the origin of the orcs. Because I know Tolkien changed his mind about this several times, but this, it's in the printed Silmarillion, so it's kind of considered the most canon. If you've seen the Rings of Power, you know that there's the character Adar, who is supposed to be one of the first orcs, essentially, and he describes that, you know, he was an elf who was kidnapped by the dark powers and twisted and experimented on until he became this kind of other thing. And we get basically that same story in this chapter of the Silmarillion. And I thought it was very interesting that how, like, Morgoth, like, he was kind of doing multiple plots, like, at once. At the same time, he's trying to convince them that Orome, the huntsman, is, like, evil and is going to take them away. So he's trying to, like, get them to run from the Valar. But at the same time, he's also capturing people and experimenting on them.
Yeah, it was interesting that he was the first, you know, or even if he didn't meet them directly, his agents were the first contact the elves had with the Valar was Melkor, his agents or his servants, rather than the good Valar, for lack of a better word. And, Orme, like you said, he comes across and it's like, he finds them in surprise. And it's interesting, 'cause it's like, why, you know, you'd think Iluvatar would want them found not hurt by Melkor, but, it's kind of interesting that Melkor is allowed to do that, you know, in the throughout the whole, you know, I mean, I guess he was allowed to do lots of bad things throughout his whole, you know, his whole time. So, but I think
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, I just thought that was interesting that it's like he's their first contact with
supernatural.
Yeah.
I think it's both a it's a great display of Melkor as sort of the antithesis of Iluvatar or even Manwë, kind of setting him up as the devil, right? Or as the antagonist, or however you want to term it. Because, you know, at the same time, he does this thing to the elves, which the way the Silmarillion puts it is potentially the most hateful thing he does against Iluvatar. It's like, of all of the terrible things that Melkor does, and we get to read about all of the terrible things Melkor/Morgoth does, and they're pretty terrible. Like, this is the one Iluvatar is actually angry about, or is, like, really mad about, is the creation of the orcs, the twisting of the elves into the orcs. And then you have, at the same time, you know, it's sort of the opposite of what we had with the dwarves. This is the angry child taking what his father has made and breaking it and twisting it and tearing it apart as much as he possibly can to make something, evil out of it. But at the same time, he's really crafty about it because of the whole setting up, you know, is the way the folks are going out and capturing them and basically, you know, causing Orome to be looked for in fear. And you see this, you know, highly intelligent use of fear. And for me, it always draws back. My favorite depiction of the devil ever was in Paralandra from C.S. Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Where you get to see both like him as sort of like the very cunning, very crafty sort of Mephistopheles character. And at the same time, he's just a total jerk. Like, he's just the worst of all possible bastards. Like,
and at the same time, too, he's just using this human as like a meat puppet.
Yep.
Throughout the whole story. So it's like it's very unsettling and unnerving the way they describe, because he's not moving naturally.
Yeah.
Because he's like possessed by this demon character, the unman.
Yeah.
He's called. And, yeah, that was really scary.
He spends his whole, like, all of the time they're awake trying to convince this this person to, you know, turn against God with these arguments and tales and everything. And then he spends the rest of his time just, like, poking Ransom in the eye to try and keep him awake.
Yeah.
Like, he's just, like it's just, and it's, like, it's such a good display of, like, Melkor. Like, he's just this, you know, he'll go down to the very bottom, just like Gollum, and just do the evil, mean thing because he can, kind of a deal.
Right. It's like he's like the essentially the most intelligent and powerful being ever created. Yeah, he can be remarkably petty and small, you know, like.
Well, it's this whole thing of corrupt, you know, attacking the elves and corrupting them that leads to the Valar going after him and like finally, like, all right, we got to get him. Because he's causing too much trouble. Like, it doesn't matter. We need to, you know, if the children are going to be safe, we have to get him, you know, get him away and bring him back to Amon with us.
And it's a curb stomp. They steamroll him. You know, destroy his base, all that stuff. Yeah. You know, like,
you see this like look of joy on Tolkis's face, and he gets let go.
Yeah, he's loose and he can just do whatever he wants. Throws Morgoth on his face. That's it. And that must have been more humiliating to Melkor than anything, because to be physically humiliated, you know, and rendered powerless. They have this chain that has been forged by Aule that they bind Melkor in. That was cool. And yeah,
What I think is interesting about that whole thing though, is like you get this very, like, it's a quick thing, like, feel from it because there's so few words about it. But like, if like on rereading it, I was like, wait a minute, it talks about there being like a siege and battle upon battle and it taking like a long time. And I'm like, what was going on? Like, what were they fighting? Like,
who? Right. And maybe those shadow monsters that were his army. Well,
I think the Balrogs were already here at this point.
Yeah, they mentioned the Balrogs. Yeah.
Because they were at the fort. They were under Sauron. The Balrogs were. So, yeah, it could be they were fighting the Balrogs, you know, some of the Maiar that we don't have named could have been, you know, in the army of the Valar. Because the elves at this point are still, you know, it's funny because Orme is like, he'll go to them and he'll lead them, you know, and he'll go back to the Valar and then he'll come back to the. So it happens a couple of times before they, you know, start, before they actually summon them to go with them to Amon. But.
And it's crazy too, because like the Silmarillion is essentially written from the viewpoint of the elves. So the elves never saw these battles, so they don't know anything about them. And I guess the Valar, when asked, the Valar won't say much about them, so that they can only say, yeah, we heard these battles were going on. We saw all those lights in the north and we felt the earth tremble and saw these fires and lights and stuff. But we don't actually know what happened. And I'm like, wow, you know, like, yeah, that'd be like if some tremendous battle between, like, I don't know, the military and like aliens from outer space was happening like on the other side of the country, and you could like see it
in Canada.
Sky. Yeah,
what's going on in Canada? What's happening in Canada? Ah, don't worry about it.
I mean, Atumno isn't Atumno in the farthest north and in the cold.
What I don't know is Canada.
It's Canada.
Oh, no. Oh. Canadians are way too nice to be from Otumno.
Yes.
But yeah.
This is a random aside, but I was just the other day, like, looking at something, and I was like, what's the most northern, the closest to the North Pole piece of land, and it is in Canada, so maybe that's...
Oh.
So Otumno is kind of the... I kind of think of it as, like, the furthest north, the coldest you can possibly be is Otumno, so that just made me think of that.
And I like, too, when they get Melkor back to Valinor, and he's like, oh, I sue for mercy, and they're like, nope, sorry. You're going into the halls of Mandos. You know,
no. Come on.
They're like, you need some time to think about what you've done. Because like they literally go like, oh, if you sue for mercy later, we'll let you out. But for justice's sake, you need to spend like, I think they say 3 entire ages of the world in the halls of Mandos.
Mm-hmm.
Which I wonder what he does. Like, do they just keep him in prison, or is it like a work thing where they like, here, break rocks, yes, make and stamp to, license plates?
You need to dig out all these holes. What for? It's something you're gonna do later, you jerk. The Mandos is just like, rah, 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 rah. And what kills me, what absolutely kills me is like, so they go in, they have this war, Tulkas takes him down, throws him on his face, they drag him off, and then you get the couple sentences afterward. But they didn't find everything, and they didn't search every corner, and they didn't find Sauron, and a bunch of bad stuff got away, and I'm like, do your job! You guys are like, it's just like, ever since the Spring of Arda, you guys are like half doing this. Come on.
Yeah, it's like that you are god level beings, you know, like you are essentially like the Olympians or you know, the Aesir or like archangels here, and you can't take care of business. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, you couldn't find all the holes? Don't you guys like radiate light? Like, how is this a problem? Like, I don't get this.
Well, but if they all got away, then we wouldn't have
Hobbit, the story. Yeah,
or exactly. Return of the King, or it's always there's always some there's always some evil or something left over that doesn't get completely rooted out. Because if it had, then there wouldn't be any it would be Arda would be heaven, if there was no evil. So
I will say they're better at rooting out evil than the New Republic. To make a Star Wars reference.
Oh gosh. Talk about like, here's how not to run a government.
like you mentioned earlier, Jeff, at around this same time, Orome is very slowly bringing the different tribes of elves to the coast of the sea so they can go to Valinor. Because they also mentioned that during this huge war between the Valar and Melkor, the ocean actually gets wider, which is interesting. Yep. They must just put plate tectonics into high gear or something. If plate tectonics is even a thing on a flat Earth, I don't know. But
I'm assuming just there was some land that was destroyed and made room because the flat Earth, the flat Arda gets flatter, I guess.
Like a pizza pie.
Yeah. They do talk about that. Like there's like the whole whatever portion of Middle Earth that is. The way it sort of slopes westward, as it goes north, like that whole thing is kind of caused by this battle. Like the fact that the southwestern portions have just sort of fallen into the ocean and it creates all these bays and things. That's what's caused by the battle. So, I mean, there is some like, going back to the original arguments, I'm like, yeah, you guys did kind of wreck a little bit of the world during this fight. I can get being a little anxious about doing that, not knowing where the children were going to be.
And Morgoth erects, or he's not Morgoth yet, but Melkor erects the Misty Mountains to I guess, stop their progress. Which was an interesting factoid, I guess, that like, oh, it's like, so when you see the Misty Mountains later, you're like, Melkor actually raised those. Because I see these articles sometimes where they're like, the geography of Middle Earth makes no scientific sense. I'm like, of course not, because it's geography that was created by angelic beings.
On a flat, you know, in a flat world.
Yeah.
But yeah, we get our first crop of new names thrown at us, and that is the three major tribes of elves at this point, at least the elves who go with Orome. Because some stay behind and become the Moraquendi, or the Dark Elves, and called dark not because they're evil necessarily, but because they have not seen the light of Valinor. But you get the three major tribes of the Eldar, or those elves who make the trip, are the Vanyar, the Noldor, and the Teleri. And the Silmarillion is most about the Noldor. We get some stuff about the Teleri, who are the elves who become famous for shipbuilding. But like the Vanyar, who are also called the Light Elves, are hardly ever mentioned at all after this.
Well, they're the ones that just kind of go to Valinor and like just hang out with the Valar. And that's kind of what they do. They're the highest elves because they kind of fulfill their purpose of being with the Iluvatar, with the Valar. You know, who's the closest to Iluvatar they can be. So they kind of fulfill their purpose, you know, of like their, I guess, what the original purpose of the elves was. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of the highest in that way. But yeah, that also makes them the most boring. Because it's like there's not much to say. Whereas the Noldor are going to be the most interesting, and not always for good reasons, but like...
Yep.
Yeah, you know, for those who may not know, like Galadriel is a Noldor. In Rings of Power, you know, a lot of the elves we see are of the Noldor kindred.
Right, because as we'll see later, they come back to Middle Earth.
Right.
From Valinor. Yeah. But you've got
You know, prior to Orome taking them along, there's another council to try and figure out what they're going to do. I often wonder how things would have played out if they'd gone the other way. Cause the choices were, do we bring them to Valinor? Or do we leave them in Middle Earth and let them tame Middle Earth? And like that, see the bring them to Valinor seems to work out pretty well for the Vanyar, you know, okay for the Teleri, not well at all for the Noldor.
Well, for some of the Teleri, cause doesn't,
yeah. Uh-huh. So
some of them, not all of them, like Curdon does okay.
And then you have all of the various different Moraquendi out there still. So I have to wonder if you just leave the elves there, let them do their elven thing for a while, how that story would have played.
And that's essentially Olmo's argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he's against bringing them to Valinor at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, because later he takes such an interest in the Middle Earth and helping the free peoples.
Well, I think we talked about last year when we did our whole like Valar episode, we kind of talked about how Olmo, I think Thomas Santoro talked about how Olmo, like he kind of echoes the music of Iluvatar, or of the Valar. Like he's kind of the closest to that music, and as such he's the kind of the closest to the children of Iluvatar. So that's why he has such a care for them compared to some of the others who, you know, are not as interested or disinterested, you know, in a lot of ways.
And I like how Iluvatar himself doesn't interfere. He kind of lets the Valar make mistakes. Or from their point of view are mistakes. I mean, everything is within the providence of Iluvatar, but they have free will. They're not his puppets. It, like he tells Melkor, it all works into my design anyway, but like he doesn't give them strict orders saying you must do this way. You know, sometimes Manwë will go to Iluvatar for counsel, but even then Iluvatar is like, you know, it's like, you know, very few of us when we pray are going to get a direct revelation from God saying, you should take this job. You should go to this school. You should do. It's like, it doesn't work that way. And it's the same way in Arda. Like, they're going to they can't just have Iluvatar tell them exactly how to solve all their problems. So it's left up to the free will of all these beings, which is the exact opposite of what Melkor just wants, slaves and automatons who does whatever he wants.
Yeah, because he knows he's not going to get people, you know, he's not, people aren't going to follow him because they love him. Like they might follow the Valar. They're going to follow him only because of fear. And that, mm-hmm. you know, trickles down to all of his subordinates through Sauron and everyone else. So,
yeah. And they say that about the orcs very specifically that they hate their master.
Yeah.
You know, Morgoth, almost like they hate him most of all, but they're afraid of him. So they do his bidding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to like think about if there was ever an orc that would hate, you know, Sauron enough to attack Sauron, or if they would be like, because they hate, you know, they hate their master most, but they fear them more than they hate them, I feel like, so they're not gonna do anything against them
except Adar himself in the Rings of Power.
Yeah very true,
where, you know, like the whole big reveal about his story is that he turned on Sauron and destroyed his physical body for a while. And it's like, yeah, like he must be the first, you know, orc in history to overcome that barrier of fear and to just like, I'm just going to let my hate drive me to kill this guy.
Yeah, well, he was an elf first, though, so that could be the difference, is that he was always, you know, he was created as a child of Iluvatar versus being twisted, you know, whatever, you know, may not want to think too much about how Melkor got the orcs, you know, from elves, yeah. But, you know, he was originally an elf versus, you know, the
something
whatever that orcs have become, yeah. Like he could have, like, I don't know if they've, you know, Adar could have seen the light of the trees. He could be a Caliquindi, which is, I believe that's the term that means elves who bathe in the light of the trees.
He mentions having seen Beleriand.
Yeah.
So he must have gone on the journey part of the way.
Oh, true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. I hope we learn more about that character.
Yeah. Well, he's in it in the next season, but it's a different, it was recast.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember how he deals with light, if he does, because that is something you find in a lot of the later books, is that the Moriquendi actually don't like the sun. They typically shy away from it and will stick to kind of night and darkness and shadow when they can. And it's not an aversion in the same way it is for the orcs. It's sort of like a choice.
They're more comfortable.
We were always in the dark beforehand, and this is sort of where we should be, kind of a deal. This was the path we chose, instead of going to Aman and going to the light of the trees.
Yeah. I remember before he sets off the volcano, Adar like stands in like a pool of sunlight, and he's like, I'm just gonna drink in this one last bit of sunlight before I turn all of Mordor into like covered with ash and clouds and stuff. So whereas like the orc who's standing next to him is like getting like his skin is like smoking and stuff. So like, you know, I mean, that first generation of elf orcs.
Yeah. Urukai were so dangerous, because they weren't affected by the light that, like, you know, regular orcs were, even though, you know, at least in the films, like, you don't really. It's been a while since I've read the Lord of the Rings, so I don't remember if the orcs are really discussed as like being burned by the sun, but at least the Uruk-hai are noted for being able to travel during the day and not be affected, or, you know, be exposed to the sun and not be affected by it.
And yeah, like, we're almost at an hour here and we've just covered the first chapter. Remember in the beginning where I'm like, oh, you know, there's not much to talk about in these chapters. Like, yeah, that's a great thing about the Silmarillion, is that it's just jam packed with stuff. But our next chapter is on Thingol and Melian, chapter 4 of the Quenta Silmarillion, where one of the chieftains of the elves who is on his way to Valinor, is Elway, and he is the chieftain of the host of the Teleri, who are they're kind of at the rear of the march. You have the Vanyar in front, then the Noldor, and then the Teleri. And Elway becomes the character who will later known as Thingol. I think they say his other Quenya name is Singolo, they call him, which I guess in Sindar becomes Thingol.
Yeah.
But he meets Melian the Maiar, and this is always such a very strange passage. I like it, but it's strange.
Yeah, he sees her, hears her singing, and sees her, and is just enraptured by her beauty enough to, you know. And I mean, if any of us saw an angel, you know, like in that, you know, not like a, you know, seraphim or whatever the ones with the big, with the thousand eyes are, but if we saw like a human like angel, like, we would probably feel, you know, in a very similar way, except we, you know, probably wouldn't be feel romantically toward that. But yeah, he's just enraptured by, and it kind of mirrors some of the, you know, some of the other stories of men meeting elvish women, which, you know, spoiler alert, his daughter is Luthien. So their daughter is Luthien.
Well, I thought it was interesting because they say that Melian has nightingales around her. That's kind of the creature that symbolizes her is the nightingale.
Yeah.
And
taught them their songs.
Right. And I think Beren's kind of, you know, pet name for Luthien is, it means nightingale, right? Tenuviel, he calls her, which I believe means nightingale. So you have nightingales as like a symbol of Luthien's mother, and Beren calls her nightingale, which I thought was an interesting connection to later in the book. But yeah, it struck me as very fairy tale like, where they kind of, they fall under a spell and they spend like centuries just gazing into one another's eyes. I'm like, that's very like fairy tale-ish. I like it's weird, but I like it. And I believe where they end up just settling down in that forest, right? That forest ends up becoming Doriath later, which is their kind of guarded realm because they're in Beleriand at this point, which if you've read The Lord of the Rings, Beleriand is not actually anywhere on the map of the Lord of the Rings, because Beleriand is a subcontinent that by the end of the Silmarillion, spoiler alert, will be destroyed. But it's basically
Beleriand's not in Rings of Power.
No, they mention it, but it doesn't exist. Yeah. Yeah.
It's under the waves by then.
But yeah. And so Thingol, he just leaves, you know, he's never seen again by most of the people of the Teleri. His brother, Olwey, has to take charge of the group, and they keep going. And Elway kind of creates his own following of who become known as the Sindar, the Grey Elves. And I believe they, at this point, I think they also mentioned the Nandor. Who I was like, wait, who? I could completely forgotten about those guys. I was like, wait, who are these guys again?
Yeah, it's elves. You know, there's all the elves start together, and then like some fall off, and some, you know, and I think even it mentions some are like, you know, picked off from the flanks by Melkor's forces, or like, you know, any who kind of fall along the wayside, or who, you know, aren't with the main group. Kind of, it seems like some of them might get taken by Melkor.
Right. But it's funny because this chapter is so short, but it's so pivotal to everything that happens later, even going down into the Lord of the Rings, because Thingol's an elf, his marriage to Melian the Maia gets that strain of essentially angelic blood into elves through Luthien, their daughter, and then later into men, because Luthien marries a mortal man, Beren.
Well, it's like that whole, we've talked about the whole purpose of it, of the elves, was kind of to ennoble men to take over, you know, to take dominion over Arda. And so you kind of through, you know, it's part of, I think it's, we can see it as part of Iluvatar's plan to ennoble them through actually giving some, you know, a little bit of that angelic, you know, blood, for lack of a better word, into the mortal race of men. Because it's all the way passed down to Aragorn and to Arwen. So yeah. It's kind of reunited through those, through them. There's other people, other descendants as well, but those are the direct descendants, genetic line. I can't think of the word, but through the ancestral line, I guess is what I mean.
Well, you see it with Thingol, like immediately, right? Because he's seen the trees, right? So he's one of those kind of elves. So he already has that sort of glow about him.
Oh, right, because they went and then came back to get their people. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah,
because the elves were like, I don't know about this whole going with you guys. There was that war thing, and I'm not sure. And they're like, all right, fine, we'll take three of you. And they're like, oh my gosh, we got to come here.
guys, you have got to see this place.
Yes. And so, but he, like, it says that, like, even spending that time with Melian, he comes out of that taller and more regal, and he's the tallest of all of the Sindarin elves, because he's not actually, you know, a Morrowindi like they are. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of like, he's almost, you know, a god among men kind of a deal, and sort of passing all of that down as it goes. It's interesting. It's always interesting to think about that, especially with Thingol's interactions later on in the storyline, and you're like, you came from here and you ended up here.
Yeah. I think it's just that whole, you know, nobody's going to be perfect. Like, you, even if you're touched by, you know, like, for lack of a better term, if you're touched by an angel, you know, like the TV show, you're still gonna, you know, you still have that air, you can still err and still, mm-hmm. you know, be, I was going to say human, but be elvish and kind of given to some of those, you know, non-angelic tendencies, mm-hmm. even the best of them can. So
I think too, cause like for reasons that we'll get into in later episodes, he really doesn't like the Noldor later. And he just kind of sees men as like Noldorian vassals, essentially, you know, like you're with the Noldor. I don't like you, you know. There's always been problems since the Noldor showed up in my domain. You know, he's like, he's.
Well, he, you get very much to feel like he feels that he is the king of Beleriand. Like, as far mm-hmm. as the elves are concerned, he is in charge.
Yeah.
And even though Morgoth's up there doing his thing, all of these other elves show up and start claiming realms. And he's like, hey, what in the heck do you think you're doing? This is my realm.
Mm-hmm. I called it.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly what happens.
It's like when my kids fight over who's sitting in what spot. I was there first. I was there first.
Yeah, it's like, and just like that, it's like, it's funny because in about 5 minutes, I'm going to sit there. And that's what Morgoth's thinking. He's like, yeah, you guys go ahead and squabble over that. My dragon's going to be ready in about 20 years.
That's the thing about Morgoth is essentially he plays the long game. You know, he is playing chess while everybody else is playing Chinese checkers.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just like, yeah, just. Like you said, just keep doing your thing. Keep fighting amongst yourselves. Yeah,
it goes back to that whole thing that's we've talked about so many times in Tolkien, you know, in this and, you know, and any of the other stuff. It's like the evil, and I mean, true for real life too. The evil wants the good divided. So, mm-hmm. you know, evil succeeds a lot of the time because you rather than making, you know, all out war, you make subtle, you know. Subtle suggestions here and there that lead to kingdoms toppling, which, you know, we'll see in a couple chapters with.
And meanwhile, not in Valinor yet, the elves who have arrived at the sea, including the Teleri and others, they get taken to Valinor in a very interesting way. Ulmo uproots an island to sail like a boat.
How cool the ocean. Would that have been?
Yeah,
to be on that island.
Yeah, he brings the Vanyar and Noldor to Aman that way, A lot of the Teleri remain behind with Ausse, the Maia Ausse, who's one of Olmo's vassals, because he likes the kind of shorelands of Middle Earth. And Círdan is actually kind of placed in charge of the Teleri who remain. I bet later he wishes he had passed on that job because he doesn't get to leave until like all the other elves are gone.
But I mean, how exciting is Valinor really? Like, it just, there's nothing going on. So like, it's probably more interesting being in Middle Earth than being
in... must have had fear of missing out, though. He's like, oh, FOMO, I can't get to Valinor.
I can't go to Valinor. I got to stay here and find out what happens. Why did I
grow
stay
my
here?
Grow my beard. I'm gonna be the bearded elf.
Right, yeah. But yeah, it's important because they become the greatest shipbuilders in Middle Earth, which will play into the story later when a certain half elf needs to go to Valinor.
Yeah. Well, and even all the way till the end, because Círdan isn't he the last elf to leave Middle Earth like ever? Like, he's the last one. He's on the last ship because when. At the end of Return of the King, when everybody leaves, not all the elves have left. Like, there's, you know, Elrond and Galadriel leaving or like the highest elves leaving, but there's still a few here and there. And Círdan he's there till the end because he's got to make sure everybody's, you know, it's like the last chopper out of Nam. He's got to make sure that everyone who wants to go can go.
I feel like it's another one of those situations where, like, Círdan makes the decision and you just hear, like, Mandos from afar. Bad call.
Yeah.
You chose poorly.
Yes. Yes. That's what I think about when I think about Mandos. He just sits in the back during the councils and then, like, they make the decision. He just leans forward. You chose poorly.
that's my image of Mandos now. He's the
guy
the
knight, from
Crusade. The knight from Last Crusade.
Crusade. Yeah. the Teleri who do take the trip basically end up staying on that island. Like, eventually Olmo just parks the island just off of Valinor. And it becomes Tol Eressëa, the Lonely Isle, which I believe is the isle that Frodo actually lives on when he goes to Valinor. It's Tol Eressëa.
Frodo and Sam, because I don't think they can step foot on like Amon proper.
Because they're mortals.
Like, it's kind of their, you know, it's kind of their, you know, loophole. They can be close, but not quite there. And because they're going to die, even though it's called, you know, but they're like, they can die on this island that's not quite there. It's like the description is really cool because the Teleri are hanging out on this island and they just start building ships. And then Olmo brings them giant swans that can pull their ships rest of the way until they kind of, you know, learn the craft of, you know, building sails and such. Mm-hmm. But it's like these swans like pull their ships. The rest of the way, they're almost like their harbor pilot or their, you know, tugboat of Valinor or giant swans.
And this chapter, which is Eldamar and the Princes of the Eldalie, is the one where you're basically assaulted with names. It's like, here's all these different people. There's going to be a quiz later.
Yeah, if you thought, you know, the elves waking up was bad, just wait. We're going 9 generations down.
The 7 sons of Feanor.
Right. We get, you know, because Finwë, you know, who's high king of the Noldor, we get his 3 sons, including Finarfin, who is name dropped in the Rings of Power because he's Galadriel. She says, I'm Galadriel of the Golden House of Finarfin. So you get him. You get, you know, Feanor and his 7 sons. You get Tolkien creates all these beautiful names, right? Yet for the Noldor's high city, he couldn't do a better job than Tuna.
Well, Tuna's not even the city. Tuna. It's the hill the city is on.
Tyrion is the city. But the hill is called Tuna.
Well, I think in, you know, it's pronounced Tuna. So, but it's still. I think that's how that, you know, if you're pronouncing it based on the actual language, that's what it would be.
But. Oh, okay. But even Andy Serkis says Tuna in the in the audiobook, and it just throws me off. I'm like, what?
I feel like he must have linguistically backed himself into a corner there and been like, oh, no. Oh, this thing's name is Tuna. Oh, but I can't change anything. Fine.
It's Tuna. In an earlier version of the Legendarium, I believe the hill is called Kor, K-O-R. And I forget, I remember reading a long and involved explanation of how it went from Kor to Tuna. But I don't remember any of it. But it is the city of the Noldor. What's important about it, though, is that Tyrion, the city, has a white tree, which I believe is the first of the kind of line of white trees that will eventually lead to the White Tree of Gondor.
Yeah, I think they say it's a fruit of Telperion, or a seed of Telperion.
They call it an image of Telperion, which I guess just means the same thing, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah, I had my book here. I was trying to see if I can find it really fast. But,
I don't remember if they trace it all the way to Gondor or just they stop at Numenor. But yeah.
Well, because. Isildur takes a fruit from the tree of Numenor, which becomes the tree of Gondor.
I don't think.
Oh, in that chapter, they don't mention it. They just
go to Numenor.
Gandalf mentions at the end of Return of the King the whole genealogy of the White Tree of Gondor. That was funny when my brother got to that part. He's like, Gandalf's talking about the genealogy of a tree. I'm like, yep.
Sure is, and it's more important than you think.
I know, right? Yeah, that's what's great about it. It goes all the way back to like the tree that was the origin. Well, I don't want to spoil it for later, but because in a later episode we'll see what comes from the Silver Tree. But I actually really like the fact that there's this whole lineage, given how much Tolkien loved trees and loved nature. That there's this whole lineage leading from Telperion, the Silver Tree, to the White Tree of Tirion, to Nimloth, the White Tree of Numenor, and eventually all the way to the White Tree of Gondor. And I just think that's really cool. I'm not sure, it's almost like how we were talking before, how there's the genealogy, Maiar ancestry going all the way down from Thingol and Melian to Aragorn and Arwen. It's kind of the same thing. And I think even Gandalf picks that up in the Return of the King. He tells Aragorn that the line of the White Tree is older than your line.
Yeah. It's like thinking about it from the Tolkien's perspective of being a linguist and a literary guy. It's almost like it's the tree. It's almost like the world tree, like Yggdrasil from Norse mythology. Ooh. You have the original trees, but then even though the original trees, are not there anymore, you still have their branches for spreading out all the way until Return of the King. So you have this, from the beginning of ages to the, because they start counting, I don't think we've talked about yet, but they start counting the ages when the trees are, they call it the years of the trees. Right. Even if they don't give a certain number of years, they call it the age of the trees. And before that, it's kind of uncounted time.
Right. There's the age of the lamps, the age of the trees, ages of the sun and moon. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's cool to see that that progression and that how it stretches from the first tree to the Tree of Gondor at the very end of Return of the King.
But the only other thing in my notes is I just wrote the princes of the Noldor rather than write down all those names. That's just what I put.
Yeah.
And as much as we've been like poking fun and laughing at this stuff, this is all really great. I love every second of it. But it's just like it's just like part of what makes me laugh is that I'm trying to imagine someone coming to this with no other background in Middle Earth and like came to the Silmarillion first. If that we would be very disorienting.
Well, that's I think that's one of the problems with that chapter, or not problems, but you know, it's if you read a book and you're introduced to a bunch of characters at the beginning and the book says these people are all important, and then you have to like through the rest of the book they slowly get introduced and you learn who they are, like at the very beginning you're like, I'm not gonna remember any of this. Like, and then when you meet them in the book you're like, okay, who was this guy? I think I've heard his name before. He was son of some guy that started with an F. They all started with F. Why do they all start with F's?
That's true.
Everybody a Finway and a Fingal and a Finn, or I don't know.
Finarfin.
Yeah. And even when they get renamed, it's still an F name. I don't get it.
There's actually an error in this chapter. Christopher admitted it later, where like it mentions Orodreth as a son of Finarfin. But he's not actually Finarfin's son. Like, I think he's supposed to be Finrod's nephew. But he's mentioned here as a son of Finarfin.
He could be, you know, kind of adopted like a son, kind of, and we can headcanon it that way. Like, he's kind of a, they adopt him in as a son. And
yeah. But I remember even later, like, Christopher was like, oh, yeah, that was a mistake. And if that's the only like canon continuity error in the whole Silmarillion, like still it's a testament to Christopher and the other people he had working to collate all this stuff, that's the only, because this was not written from beginning to end. This is trying to weave together many different texts that Tolkien wrote at many different parts of his life.
Yeah, and there was no computer, you know, you couldn't have an Excel spreadsheet pulled up.
No or, Scrivener.
You know, or anything to, yeah, kind of keep it all straight other than writing it out. And, you know, probably like the Charlie Day meme of like the conspiracy red string board of Christopher trying to organize the Silmarillion. But if you're getting, you know, for our listeners, if you're getting caught up on the names and such, I mean, there will be more names, but We're about to get into some, you know, some actual like plot, you know, because in these chapters, like they're interesting and they're cool, but it's not a lot of like you kind of just get a high overview. You don't really get the kind of the big accounts of battles or big accounts of this journey. They're just like, and the elves journeyed and then Orme came back and he left, and just very high overview. And then but we're about to kind of get into more of an actual like narrative story with. And focus on these characters. So if you're having trouble, you know, right now, just stick with it. I know we keep saying, you know, it does get a little bit easier to follow, as you go. So
it's like that. I don't know if you guys saw, Dom dropped this funny headline from the Babylon Bee in our Slack channel where it said like, sad man gives up on his Silmarillion in a year reading plan.
Yeah, it was so good.
That was good. Great.
Yeah, but I mean, bringing it into small chunks is a good way to do it, like we're kind of doing. And in the chapters, some of them are going to get, you know, a little bit longer, but like we keep saying, you kind of keep it as, don't just try to power through it as like you would if you were like just, if you're a fast reader like me, I have a hard time slowing down. But like when I read something like this, I have to like really slow down and think about what I'm reading, and I'm not just trying to like figure out what happens next in the plot. Like a lot of it is kind of the nuance of the language and the, you know, kind of, you kind of have to imagine some of the, what's going on, because there's not a lot of description in this part of what's going on. You just kind of get, because a lot of it's being told as like it's like a legend being passed down, you know, it's not like you're reading a novelization of the actual interactions of a lot of this. It's just very high overview.
Right. Yeah. It's like if you know, it's very biblical sounding language, or like the old sagas, or like the Greek myths or something. It's that kind of, it's not close in character stuff like it would be in, you know, in Lord of the Rings or in The Hobbit.
Yeah, like if you've ever read through Genesis, it starts very broad strokes. Mm-hmm. And eventually you get down, like Noah is kind of the first real story where you're talking about individual actions and a continuous dialogue and a set of things happening. And then once you get to Joseph's story, like it's a story at that point.
It's straight up human drama.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so that's sort of where we're at. We're still, we haven't got to Noah yet. We're kind of in that portion of Genesis where it's still very kind of vague and you're getting a lot of very high, broad stuff. And you get these random asides about things that actually do take, you know, like the creation mm-hmm. of the dwarves and Thingol and Melian. You kind of get specific stuff, but everything else is sort of very high level. But mm-hmm. we'll get there. We'll get to the fun stuff.
Yeah. And then I can't remember which chapters are next, but I feel like we should be getting Jeff, you have a copy of the Silmarillion right in front of you.
Yeah. The next chapter I think is it's also a great heavy metal band of Fëanor and the Unchaining of Melkor. Yes.
That would be a great heavy metal band. Yeah. That's awesome. Somebody has to do that.
But yeah, it's, we're about to get into some of like the big, actually get into the Silmarils.
Yes, and have Fëanor be introduced as a character and get to see why he's a big, well, I can't use that word on this show, so I won't, but he's a jerk.
Yeah.
But he makes for a really interesting character. So, you know, I remember though seeing, I didn't watch it, but I remember seeing like a video on YouTube once where it's like, why Fëanor is actually the hero. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Interesting.
Why Fëanor was right. You know, I'm
like, you're like,
from a certain point of view, maybe. I mean, like
wrong universe.
Right. Yeah. Somewhere out in the Tolkien universe, it turned out that multiverse, it turned out better for him.
Fëanor was right, like Thanos was right.
But before we wrap up tonight's discussion, we do have a little bit of feedback on our Patreon episode, which was finally put out for the rest of our excellent listeners to hear, where we answered some questions from our patrons. Paul Leon writes us, great conversation. As far as the blue wizards go, my theory is both of Tolkien's theories were true. One of the blue wizards fell and started a mystery cult that endured into the Fourth Age. The other one was loyal and rallied resistance to Sauron in the East that was crucial in keeping Gondor from being overwhelmed. And a future topic I'd like to see would be an episode about the Maiar, especially in light of what's revealed in the nature of Middle Earth. Ooh, I actually haven't read that book yet, but I just ordered it. I just ordered it the other day. So I'm actually very interested in digging into that. Although I hear it's a lot about elvish lifespans and their biology and stuff, which should be interesting, but.
Yeah, I've heard that one gets very, very, and I feel like before I even get near that one, I need to read the history of Middle Earth books before I even try to, because that's like, I think I think that's the last kind of unpublished Tolkien there is.
Right.
You know, unless they find a basement full of
unpublished manuscripts.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I think if you liked that stuff in the Lord of the Rings appendices about calendars, I think there's more of that in the nature of Middle Earth.
Yeah, if you want elvish genealogy, I think that's your place to go.
But I liked Paul's kind of synthesis of both of the theories about what happens to the blue wizards. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I like that one. I like that better than both of them going bad. That just it seems so sad that that was their fate.
Yeah, yeah, which is, I think, why Tolkien changed it in later writings. Although the thing about having the mystery religion endure into the Fourth Age is interesting, because I wonder if that ties in to the Dark Tree cult that's in the New Shadow.
I think that's what most people assume.
Yeah,
that's sort of wrapped around that, but I, you know, there's no definite pointer, right? But I think most people are like, yeah, that's probably got something to do with it.
Right, because, like, who's left? You know, Sauron's gone. Saruman is gone. Who could be the new Dark Lord? And it's, like, one of the blue wizards, maybe?
Or a surviving Balrog, or some other random Maiar that's running around out there. Yeah.
But the new Shadow and its infuriating cliffhanger ending could be a whole episode in itself.
Yeah, I've not read it, so that's something, if we ever get to it, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. But that's it for this episode of The Secrets of Middle-earth. But before we go, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Cody B., Father Matthew N., Michael H., Slow, and Alex S. Their generous donations help us to continue to create The Secrets of Middle-earth and all of the shows here at StarQuest. And you can join them at sqpn.com/give. And now we'd like to hear from all of our listeners. What did you think about these chapters of the Silmarillion? You can let us know on our Facebook page or on Twitter, or you can send us an email to middleearth@sqpn.com. You can leave a comment on our YouTube channel, or you can visit the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord. And join us next time for a special Tolkien Reading Day special covering the topic of service and sacrifice. Thank you, Jeff Hecker, for joining me this week on The Secrets of Middle-earth.
Thank you, Thomas.
And Pat Mason, thank you as well.
Oh, you're very welcome. Great to be here.
And until next time, I'm Thomas Salerno. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Middle-earth on StarQuest.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy, The Catholics of Oz. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/Oz.